Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 27th of October. A podcast that would never pay for a blue tick or even a gold tick. We've just had a fantastic conversation with James Bull, which is the second half.
Our colleague and guru on social media disinformation, unpacking what's going on with the information war in the Middle East crisis.
Yeah.
Really fascinating.
And more broadly.
Is
up to, you know, I thought, but the first half was dedicated, devoted, especially to Rishi Sunak.
1 year on.
My God.
A year of infamy.
infamy. They've all got it infamy. Well, I think we're both passionate on the subject, so I definitely think it's worth listening to, isn't it?
I mean, I think, you know, it would have been wrong to allow the milestone to pass without paying our respects to our diminutive, glorious leader.
So what should we call this episode? Rishi Sunak, it got worse. It got even worse.
Who's worse, Rishi or Elon?
Yes, from bad to worse. Rishi to... Elon to Rishi from bad to worse.
Like that.
Yeah? Okay. Okay, so this is the Two Matts, episode 19, from Rishi to Elon, from bad to worse.
Enjoy.
Enjoy. So what are we going to talk about, Matt?
I think we can't avoid the fact that this week marked one glorious year of Rishi Sunak in number 10.
Amazing.
A milestone.
Amazing milestone these days. I mean, to be fair,
you know, compared to Liz Truss, it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
He celebrated the one-year anniversary with the suspension for 6 weeks of one of his MPs, Peter Bone, which could lead to another by-election. But before we sort of dig in, shall we have a taste of the way it was
when
things were, you know, on the sunlit uplands and all
what
that.
What was our wonderful leader saying this time 12
Matt,
months ago?
Producer Matt, can you give us a quick taste of what he was saying?
The government I lead will not leave the next generation, your children and grandchildren, with a debt to settle that we were too weak to pay ourselves. I will unite our country, not with words, but with action. I will work day in and day out to deliver for you. This government will have integrity, professionalism, and accountability at every level. Trust is earned, and I will earn yours.
That must be a record for the uses of the word I in a...
Even by his own exacting standards.
That was quite heavy on the old I.
It was a portent of things to come.
It was.
What was not a portent of things to come was getting the trust back of the British people, because just checking the most recent polls, Ipsos has Labour on 20 points ahead.
Yeah.
And GB News poll by People Polling has Labour on 28 points ahead. So I'm not sure he's quite sold the line yet.
No. No.
I mean, okay, all right, let's break the habit of a lifetime and be scrupulously fair.
Yeah.
What's he done? He and Jeremy Hunt have kind of ended the fiscal lunacy of the Liz Truss interregnum. and he's made some progress on inflation, though whether that's actually being felt by people yet, I don't really believe. He's been firm on Ukraine and Hamas. He did get the Windsor framework sorted in February, although that was to sort out a problem created by Brexit that he heartily endorsed. So I don't think he deserves a huge amount of credit. He just won the Uxbridge and Ruislip by-election in July. He's won cross-party support for his very personal niche obsession with phasing out smoking, and that's about it.
Yeah. You've written a really long, epic essay. I don't call these articles. I call them essays because it's more than an article. And it's for this week's New European, or
the one coming up.
Yeah. Actually, it's the next edition. And it's, you know, the headline is Sunak laid bare. And you come to a conclusion, which I completely concur with, which is that you can make a very strong case for saying that he's the worst of the lot.
I do think he's the worst of the lot. And I have thought so for a while, actually. When he was campaigning in the first leadership contest, which he lost to Liz Truss, I was struck by how aggressively he went on culture wars, saying the only thing that was wrong with the Rwanda policy was it wasn't tough enough. And I thought, this is interesting. Because, you know, he comes from a background where, you know, he's not a culture warrior by temperament. But he obviously thought, if I'm going to hold together Boris Johnson's 2019 coalition, I need to be really, really nativist and populist.
Yeah.
And the calculation in his populism and the extent to which he's let Suella Braverman say some truly horrendous things is, I think, the core to understanding his kind of Faustian pact in getting the top job. And while there are some people, if you like, the Davos classes, who are quite lulled by his, you know, his appearance of sobriety and common sense, I think that the way he's used that very dangerous politics, and God knows, you know, we're in now in the middle of a international conflict in which those sorts of energies and passions are spilling out onto the streets of cities all over the world. You know, they are not to be, they're not things to toy with. You know, it's very dangerous tinder. Just to turn to it. And I think very poorly of him on that.
Yeah.
I think that the promise he made in that clip, you know, about ethics, well, you know, he reappointed, one of the first things he did was reappoint Suella Braverman.
Who'd just been sacked
after as Home Secretary. And he dithered over Nadeem Zahawi's tax affairs. He was the chairman at the time. He got a report into the allegations of bullying against Dominic Raab, which was clearly, you know, grounds for resignation. And he sat on that for a while thinking, is there any way of keeping Raab? There wasn't. So finally, Raab resigned in April. You know, instead of actually renovating standards in public life, he's allowed people like Raab to talk about activist civil servants, whatever that means. Yeah. And he's talked about the permanent state Sunak has, which is really a version of the deep state MAGA talk. And I mean, we've talked about this a lot, but I think the thing that I hold against him most is that he's not living in the present. You know, we've talked a lot on this podcast over the weeks about, you know, the first question a politician needs to ask is, what time is it? What year is it? And I think he thinks it's about 1985 when he was five.
Yeah.
You know, Nigel Lawson, the picture behind his desk at the Treasury.
Yeah.
You know, what does he learn from the pandemic? Nothing.
Mm.
The only thing he learns is that he hates handing out money. He, you know, he wants to wind down all the schemes. You know, he's the infrastructure he got developed during COVID has been more or less melted down or absorbed into other bodies, so that our pandemic resilience is no greater than it was when COVID hit.
Mm.
And I think that he's a figure from the past. And I, to be honest with you, I think that for all the talk of renewal and reshuffles, that they're now operating a damage limitation strategy.
You think so? Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you look at the things they're floating, you know, they're going very anti-green. They're floating things like stamp duty cuts and inheritance tax cuts. I mean, you know, pro-motorist stuff. This is core Tory vote.
And abolishing the cap on the bankers' bonuses.
Right.
Astonishing. I mean,
this is what you do when you have realised you cannot win.
Yeah.
But you don't want to go down to an absolute landslide defeat. So you're trying to shore up the Tory vote. Now, I'm not sure even those things will cut much ice, because I think they're the kind of measures that might have worked in a little bit with traditional Tory voters in the 90s and certainly did vote in the 80s. I'm not sure that they cut much ice in the 2020s.
I mean, I find him quite a repellent character. Obviously, I've never met the guy. Maybe he's a really nice person face to face. But as you said just a moment ago, the fact that he facilitates Suella Braverman's ongoing political career shows to me that he is a coward of the highest order on two fronts. One is that he is terrified of confronting her, because what confronting her means about the future of the Conservative Party. But also on a personal level, I feel like he's terrified of confronting her. I just don't feel like he's a big enough person, right? Imagine if you came into politics in these circumstances where you know the entire nation is absolutely fed up of Tory messing about and shenanigans. You're the fifth prime minister in 7 years. You're following on from the worst prime minister in British history, Liz Truss, who followed on from the second worst prime minister in British history, Boris Johnson. So there's nothing to lose, right? And yet, and you put on your Prada suit and your thin tie and you stand there with your hair immaculately coiffed and say, I will bring back integrity to government, and some nonsense like that. And there's, what I find appalling about him is his actually his lack of ambition.
Yes.
The lack of wherewithal to say, do you know what, folks? Fuck this. Fuck it. I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to do something transformative, because it's lost. So I'm going to do something.
He's got a working majority of 60,
yes,
right, which most prime ministers in history would kill for.
Yeah.
Right? He could do all sorts of things, even if it is in a very brief period. It's interesting because I do have, and we've talked about this, I do have this great sense of an ending of a long era. And a terrific recently published book, which I can't recommend highly enough, by Ben Reilly Smith.
Oh, yeah. He was on the Newsagents podcast.
Right. He's a political editor of the Daily Telegraph. Yeah. And he's written this book called The Right to Rule, which is about the 13 years of Tory prime ministers, five prime ministers. It's a real, I mean, not all political books are, you know, page turners. This really is.
Yeah.
And it will be a while before it's bettered. It's
great.
A really excellent book. So if listeners sort of want a feeling, you know, change in the air, they want to get a sense of what's coming down the road with Labour, but also what did all that amount to? You know, 2010, suddenly David Cameron comes in with the Lib Dems, lots of modernisation talk, and now we're in 2023 and it's all about, you know, small boats and herding people onto barges, and how did that happen? This book really is excellent on that.
Do you know, and there was a very good episode of the Newsagents with Emily Maitlis and John Sopel talking to him. I think John's thesis was it didn't matter how good Rishi Sunak was. You know, after 13 years of this brigade, nobody is good enough to rescue the Tory party, and it's just come to a natural conclusion in its current shape and form. But I just don't buy into that thesis at all.
No, I think it acquits him too much. And I think that you have to look, I mean, you know, Gordon Brown came at the end of 13 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were moments in those crucial coalition building days when it looked as if he might be able to stay on as prime minister.
Yeah, and you'd look at Gordon Brown versus Rishi Sunak.
No, you know, comparison.
No, I mean, honestly, one is a Boy Scout.
Different
league. One's a Boy Scout and the other's a grown man doing an amazing job.
Different league.
An adult.
I mean, I think the amazing thing about it is that these 13-year periods are really instructive. You know, New Labour only had Blair and Brown. You go back to the 51-64 Tory government. There was Churchill, Eden, Macmillan, Douglas Hume. But, you know, all of them, including Douglas Hume, substantial figures.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, look back in anger. You've got Cameron, May, Johnson, Truss, Sunak, your face.
Yeah.
Says it all.
And each of them managing to outdo the predecessor in crapness.
I mean, it is not glad, confident morning again, is it? I mean, I think it is. I do think that this is the end of an era that's not just going back to 2010, but actually goes back to 1979. That the Conservative, there's been a long Conservative empire in which New Labour was a sort of, you know, it was part. It bought into a lot of conservatism, though adding a social justice element. But now is the time for a change. You know, that's that long kind of 40 plus year period is over.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I have to say, I don't believe, with the best will in the world, that Keir Starmer is the guy that's going to deliver that change.
This is the huge unanswered question, because if I have a fear about it all, it's that we do need a big change, and if Labour doesn't provide it, then you get into the terrible terrain of populism having an even greater appeal.
And maybe his biggest crime is that he's not testing Starmer. He's not pushing him. If you take the two conferences, it was such a doddle for Starmer to come in and wipe Sunak's, you know, banal conference statements off the public's memory and impose his own. You know, if you put it into football terms, what you would want is Manchester City and Liverpool battling each other and having to be relying on great tests of strength and character. Sorry to all the Arsenal fans. I couldn't have said Man United at the moment. But anyway, you take the point. You want two great titans going at each other and raising their game as they go. We've got Accrington Stanley versus, you know, I don't know, Crawley. And with the greatest will in the world, they're not world-class teams. And you want some world-class characters to be able to raise the whole nation's boats with the tide. It's not happening, and I can't see it happening for quite some time.
It's true, and I do worry that Starmer is going to get into Downing Street. I've no doubt that he's capable of getting into Downing Street, and he will look like a plausible prime minister. Let's be fair, he does look like a plausible prime minister. But the things that are waiting in his in-tray, I mean, it's a worse in-tray than Thatcher inherited in 1979. So the question is not so much, can he win? I think he can win. He deserves to win.
Yeah, yeah.
But what does he do when he gets there?
Yeah.
And to that, I think one can honestly say, I don't know yet.
I hope I'm hopelessly wrong on this, by the way. I hope he comes in. I think he, as you say, I'm sure he will. I hope he comes in. I hope he has a good working majority. I hope he's got something to do with that majority. You know, I hope he's got the ideas behind the tactical performance, which has been clever. You know, if you're, who was it that said, never interrupt your enemy while they're making mistakes?
Well, allegedly Napoleon, although I think it probably wasn't.
But anyway, the point being, you know, if the opposition is screwing up to that degree, then keep your mouth shut and just don't make any major howlers. I think the opposition is screwing up to such a degree that you'd want more from Keir Starmer and Labour right now. At this point, you'd want more. The conference was good, and they made some good noises around housing and education and so on and so forth. But you'd want more of a sense that there's a leader here in waiting. Yes. And you don't get that feeling from
Keir. Well, what the country's going to need is, you know, Attlee-style reforms, you know, Beveridge-style reforms, big, big, big risks.
Yeah.
You know, the question I have yet to sort of have answered satisfactorily, just by observing, but also by people around Starmer, is he ready to take a risk that might not come off?
Yeah, right.
Because
that's the definition of leadership.
That is the definition of leadership. I mean, he's brilliant at reassuring. I mean, credit where it's due. He has taken the anti-Semitic stain off Labour. He has got them in line. He has reassured the markets. He's done all the things that a reassurance strategist should do. But you can't govern, particularly you can't govern in 2024 just by reassuring people. The world is not in that sort of condition. People will need to understand that the big and painful changes are ahead, and they need to be.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to imagine those words in his mouth. We'll see.
And also what the world looks like once we've gone through those changes.
Absolutely.
That's the important thing. Yes. You've got to know where you're going. I think he's kind of tried to articulate that.
Well, the one thing I did like in the conference on that front was the decade of renewal.
Yes, that was
because
a good
what
phrase,
he was saying was basically, I need two terms.
Yeah.
And that's good thinking.
And
that's
there was something Kennedy-esque about the decade of challenge.
Right. You know, this is going to be hard.
This is our moonshot.
Yes.
But that's the literal specific about what's missing is what does Britain look like at the end of that decade of renewal? You know,
the problem is that they haven't actually named a moon to go to yet.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my point.
It's not really clear what the moon is.
And I don't think they know really. But you need somebody. When you think about Blair coming in, and the people he had around.
They had many.
Alistair, you know, Philip Gould, all, you know, real kind of heavyweight
Mandelson,
communicators.
Angie Hunter, you know.
Absolutely amazing communicators. And I don't, I've no idea who's writing this stuff for Keir Starmer, but I don't really think that they've got that level of communication expertise. And it's going to become more and more important, I think, that they can sell the dream.
Someone who's engaged in sort of getting them ready in terms of manifesto preparation told me the other day that they've got a bunch of policies, but they don't have a narrative,
which
is exactly your point.
Yeah.
That they've got a list of things they want to do, but what they don't have is a thing to bind it together that they can then not just go onto the doorstep, because I don't think this is just about the election. In fact, I don't think it's really at all about the election. But afterwards, and say, right, this is what we're going to do in the first 100 days.
Yeah, I want to know what is my role, right? I'm being egotistical, as a citizen. But what is role as a citizen in reshaping this country so that it's something better? What's the British dream? Not the American dream. What's the British dream for this epoch?
Yes.
I've got skills. You've got skills. Everyone's got skills. How can these skills be galvanised? All I hear from Keir Starmer is we've got massive problems and the state is going to step in and solve these problems.
A bit.
Yeah, a bit. And it's going to be really painful. I want to know how I can help solve these problems as a citizen. You know, what is it I can do?
I mean, one thing that he could do without spending a dime would be to say, look, Boris Johnson fell in 2022 because of an ethical crash, which the Tories then responded to by having an argument about tax cuts. Okay.
Yeah.
There are a whole load of things that could be done at marginal cost to radically improve trust in public standards in public life. You could do them in the first 100 days.
Yeah.
You make a speech, you say, there's no point in me doing anything unless you guys trust not only me and not only the government, but the whole system.
Yeah.
And I understand why you don't. For example, just as a for instance, the independent advisor to the Prime Minister on ministerial standards, Laurie Magnus, who's a very tough person, cannot initiate his own inquiries. They have to be triggered by the Prime Minister themselves.
Yeah.
Now, that's insanity. You know, obviously, to be independent, that advisor should be able to sleuth around Whitehall doing whatever they want.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't cost a penny, but it's a significant change. It says, right, I'm now making my government totally and utterly transparent, and Sir Laurie will be, you know, roaming around and God help anyone who fouls up.
Yeah.
Whereas at the moment, he has to go, if he's Prime Minister Starmer, he has to go to him and say, would you look into whoever it is?
And if the Prime Minister is the villain, that's the equivalent of marching into the police station and saying, I've just committed the crime.
And also, I think that there should be some tightening of what the Prime Minister has to do, because as we've seen in the past, the Prime Minister doesn't always follow the advice of the independent advisor.
Yeah,
things like that, you know. It's more than 25 years since the Nolan Commission. And it's time for not only some actual change, but a sense of response to what people feel.
Yeah.
They just don't trust the system.
Just before we go to a break, what's your favourite Rishi Sunak moment of the last 12 months?
I think when he almost disappeared behind a lectern. I think it was a stop the boats, because as you know, the mottos have changed over but it was a stop the boats one, and he came out with his physics revision notes, and you thought, oh, he's kneeling, is he sorting out something? He's not. No, there he is in his little trousers, right? You could barely see him. I mean, it is hilarious. You'd have to heart of stone.
I think the petrol pump fiasco, it takes lot to beat.
But that was glorious.
I think my single favourite moment was when he was helping out in the soup kitchen and he asked the homeless guy what line of business he was in. The guy just looked at him and said, mate, I'm homeless. It was like,
I'm in the being on the pavement line of business.
Right, okay. Well, okay. Thank you very much for listening, folks. Hope you're enjoying the show so far. We're going to come back in the second half with a really superb guest talking about disinformation, which will be a great listen.
Very much on the pace at the moment.
On the media podcast this week, we also have the new European's James Ball, but on other stories entirely, including the auction to buy the Telegraph Media Group. But will it all be derailed before a buyer's found? Also on the programme, 50 years old and commercial radios in rude health, according to the latest data. We unpack the findings. Plus, as TV stops commissioning new shows, what's it really like for the freelancers that do all the work? We speak to one director frustrated at the way they've been treated. That's the media podcast with me, Matt Deegan. There's a link link in the show notes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So welcome back to the Two Mats. I'm really delighted to say we've got James Ball with us.
Our colleague.
Yes, a writer on many organs, but most notably, I would say, in the New European every week.
Of course.
Your wonderful deconstructed column takes apart issues and explains stuff to the world. So explain this to me. You're a great information, disinformation expert. Has the dialogue on social media ever been worse than it is right now?
I mean, I was about to call it a cesspit these days, but that would be an insult to cesspits, which actually carry out a useful societal function. I mean, essentially, you have kind of got to see what happens if you put a clown, like a clown, in charge of major infrastructure over the last year. It's a year this week that Elon took over. Yeah. And Twitter wasn't some brilliantly managed heavenly Elysium place beforehand, but it could not have been worse if it was designed to. I mean, one thing that strikes me, I've been posting a bit on the disinformation and the really nasty polarization side of it, and it is viciously unpleasant. And it's not Elon Musk's fault that people act like twats on the internet. And
although it is his fault, presumably, James, that he laid off so many people who were meant to, you know, check content moderation and...
Yeah. I mean, I've been called a capo at least 5 times in the last 3 days, which is, you know, it's not a well-known insult. I would encourage you to Google it because I don't want to get into it. No, but it's about one of the worst things you can be called.
Not nice.
But, you know, I posted about people ripping down posters and the deluge on that.
These are pictures of hostages.
Yes, the hostages.
Pro-Palestinians are yes.
Well, I would say it's not pro-Palestinian to rip down those posters. It's pro-terrorist. It's pro-Hamas.
If you're
ripping down posters, I'm sorry. You know, that doesn't count for me as supporting the civilian victims.
This was the backlash, the capital insult.
But this sort of thing, that's the fact that Elon got rid of moderation. And community notes doesn't replace moderation. And this is also where their kind of nonsense theory that getting rid of reach and making abusive things not reach doesn't work. Because most of those things are audience of one. And people discover them in the replies and their friends discover them in the replies and join in. And so their philosophy that you don't need to moderate totally misunderstands the nature of abuse and pylons. The bigger problem, and I actually wrote about this in the New European recently, is the misinformation that goes around. And it's an immensely difficult story to report. You know, I think the honest mistakes that most of the world's media made over the hospital show it's very difficult. you can't really treat either side as a reliable narrator. You've got all of that. But what Elon has done is changed blue tick to mean a verified media source, to mean you pay $8 a month, and not only might you still, to a casual user, look to have some credibility, but the algorithm will promote you very heavily. And also, you will get paid depending how many views you have, and there are no standards on who gets monetized and demonetized. Mm. So if you push too hard on YouTube, if you go full QAnon on YouTube, you'll get demonetized. So you might get 10 million views, but you won't get the ad revenue for it. That doesn't happen on Twitter. And so what accounts are doing, completely cynically, with no politics behind it, is they're taking footage from video games, from Syria, from Russia and Ukraine, showing something blowing up and presenting it as breaking news or as something that's happened.
Or old speeches by world leaders and then just putting phony...
Often cutting out keywords and sentences, doing that. And so it's not just a kind of what happens if you neglect it. Social media now is set up to amplify and encourage. Twitter is paying, well, X is paying money to people to push out grotesque misinformation about a horrendous conflict in which thousands of civilians are dying and suffering, but also which could easily ignite the Middle East or the world. Yeah. There aren't words for quite how terrible what he's doing is.
So what's the right response to this, though? I mean, cause, so I bet one question that a lot of people are thinking as they hear you describe this is, why do you engage with it anymore? It's a question I ask about the New European, is why do we bother anymore? Because it's almost immaterial to us as a business that we are present on Twitter. It makes no real difference to our business. And I kind of sit there thinking, what the hell are we doing here anymore? It's such a loser's place. But anyway.
I think I've taken a view over the year that it still has enough residual value. There's enough interesting people there. That kind of social media network, nothing else is tied to real time and nothing else is tied to current affairs. And a lot of the Twitter clones are actively saying, we're not trying to do that bit because that bit's hard. Right. And so until very recently, the value's been there. I'm an advisor on a documentary about Elon Musk that's coming out in 2025. Right. And social media is the bit I know about. And so I probably can't quit the field until I have to.
But I
have hit the point now where, for the first time in the last few weeks, I've thought, if I wasn't needing to cover this as a story, I think I would be off it now.
Yeah.
But Elon doesn't get that it doesn't work for publishers. Like, it wasn't a big driver of traffic for anyone beforehand. No. But people sort of liked it because it was how your peers might see a story and how they might look at it. And more people, even who are still there, are just on broadcast now. The value is dropping like hell.
I think that's definitely true.
Is there any information yet, James, about how much of this is coming from outside the region? Is there Russian intervention on social media? Are there other state actors coming in?
We don't really know yet. And one of the difficulties is a lot of the research tools have been turned off. Now, Twitter was always better than the other social networks for offering access to these to academic researchers and others. Elon essentially set the cost to use the research API prohibitively expensively, as if you were a global enterprise trying to get it for some mysterious reason. You know, it's been priced so high, no one could ever use it. But there were always little workarounds and tricks you could do that are technically against the terms of service, but could work. And he's very publicly threatened, of all places, the Anti-Defamation League. But other places that were doing research on hate speech, on bots, on this kind of thing, have had quiet warnings. And so there's a lot less quick identification than there used to be. People will be doing their usual tricks. You can sort of see quite a lot of the signs that Israel or Israel-affiliated hackers are possibly attacking some major pro-Palestinian accounts. I'm sure there's some of that going the other way. It would be odd if Russia decided to sit this one out, although they're sort of riding both horses in this one. Yeah. And so you can sort of get to this level of chaos. Once you start saying to trolls, we'll give you thousands of dollars if you push out misinformation, which is what Elon's saying. You know, if you advertise on Twitter, your money is going to fund Israel-Palestine disinformation. Yes. Like, that is the core message.
That's the content.
You know, that's there is no escaping that.
Yes.
But also, Twitter directly now hands revenue to that. Twitter's only money comes from the $8 a month, which comes nowhere near covering their cost. So if you are giving Twitter money, you are fueling the blue tick misinformation. You know, consider your brand next to it, because someone will overlay it with it at some point.
What do you reckon is his long-term plan is for Twitter then, in terms of making it a business? I mean, I know he's, you know, inordinately wealthy, but I presume he does want to make it profitable at some point.
I mean, the nature of modern wealth is you can't ever turn it into cash. And he needs cash at the moment because Twitter's burning it. And if he starts pulling it out of Tesla too quickly, Tesla will deflate.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that Tesla couldn't stay big, but it's a very delicate confidence game to keep it big. And so he can't just put $5 billion a year into Twitter.
So he needs Twitter to start improving. What's his plan, do you think?
I mean, the way he seems to be trying to do it is that the beatings will continue until morale improves. He takes more and more.
Which is very much my approach as a New European, as you both know.
Yes. As well we know.
We've tried and tested.
We've all got the press day bruise.
I only work with people who actually enjoy that shit.
The New European, the masochists newspaper.
Beat you till you cheer up.
And by the way, that goes for subscribers too.
Yes, be warned, folks. Yeah. He means it.
You will enjoy this newspaper.
But essentially, you know, people got very confused by it because he doesn't want anyone to leave Twitter. And so, as in, not just quit it, as in, I used Twitter when, do you remember RSS feeds where you could just have a little feed from your news outlets and it was there? When that died, I used Twitter at first like an RSS feed, but then you could chat to people about it and then it kind of turned into a social network for me. I always use it to find stuff to read. You know, I think I'm not the only person. I've started going back to newspaper online front pages again. But even papers I pay subscription for, I would get almost everything through Twitter. Twitter had a newsletter service where you could make and sell newsletters on it. He canned that, but then banned Substack links.
Yes.
It's like, well, you don't want to offer the product yourself and you don't want other people to go. So he's trying to sort of degrade the service in the hope that you'll pay him for it, in the hope that you'll trust him that if you pay him for it, it'll be good.
Yeah.
Which has never worked. That is the plan.
There's a sort of analogy with popular mainstream newspapers, and certainly here, but across the world, really, when they degraded the quality of the content and the user experience on their own websites, and then realized that the ad dollars, the ad pounds weren't there anymore. So thought, oh, subscription's the way to go. But guess what? By that time, everyone was thoroughly convinced that the product was shit.
Yes.
And weren't about to start paying you to make it better. So, you know, I kind of feel like that, as you suggest, that is a route to he
doesn't understand it well enough to make choices. It's just like things of, okay, he's paying something out to creators now, but in a very inconsistent way. But most people who would run a social network would understand the users that have followers and get engagement are your product.
Yes.
You need to court them, win them over, keep them. You don't need to constantly troll them. Yeah. And essentially, Elon came in absolutely hating all the blue ticks because he didn't feel like part of the club. And so he took on Twitter's power user base, sort of came in going, screw you all, I hate you all, you know, I'm going to build a better thing. And then all the sort of people who had no followers and got no engagement got blue ticks and then realized that actually they still get piss all content because it's not the blue tick on the old system that got you viral. It was doing good tweets.
That's right.
Unfortunately, they still don't do good tweets.
That's right.
You know, I sort of find most of my tweets don't get as much engagement as they used to because there's not as many people. But, you know, I'm tickless. I haven't paid. I don't have a hidden one or anything like that. My overall numbers are about the same as they ever were. You know, my following count's about the same as it ever was.
Mine too, yeah.
You know, It turns out my particular brand of bad tweets get enough people wanting to shout at me still that
exactly.
You know, the tick, it wasn't the tick that got the
You've
numbers.
You've always been reliable in that regard.
No. So it's why you pay me at the New European.
Exactly.
Just on the sort of basics of, you know, social media as a sort, which it was originally a source of citizen journalism. Presumably, there's a huge problem in Gaza, which is that people aren't going to be able to recharge their phones or indeed get internet access. I mean, there's going to be a big, just in terms of finding out what's going on, it's going to get harder and harder, I assume.
I mean, yes, although you have to think this is not the first rodeo of anyone on the Gaza Strip, and journalists there are very used to operating in incredibly difficult circumstances, including without power. People often...
Generators and so forth.
Or small solar panel kits and things like that. And, you know, those work for phones. There's only so much you can do if the comms infrastructure isn't there. But again, sometimes you can have a booster so you can get to a tower on the other side.
Right.
Sort of, there's lots of tricks that journalists there know. I think compared to the difficulties of operating with the huge degree of fear and lack of safety that they have...
Yeah.
I think the infrastructure is probably one of the smaller problems there. But only because this isn't unexpected for them. You know, it's easy to think because of the scale of what's happening, it's new.
How does it compare with Ukraine?
Essentially, the infrastructure in Ukraine is a lot better. And also, there is much more international willingness to supplant it and to come in and to support it. It's not like Israel is going to let people in to help the communications infrastructure when they're barely letting food and water in.
Yeah.
And so as a reporting sort of situation, it's much less safe. You know, reporters on the front line in Ukraine obviously were taking significant risks, although often Ukraine had some quite experienced forces who would make sure they weren't at the worst of the front line kind of thing. And if you were reporting from Kyiv or other places, there were places to go when the airstrike sirens went. You know, Gaza does not have an extensive underground network like Kyiv did. You know, the tunnels aren't there. The safety isn't there for the people reporting it. So, you know, I saw footage just today of the Gaza bureau chief of Al Jazeera lost his family who did live there.
Yeah.
The very small number of Western reporters who are there don't have their families there, but they will have friends, they will have all sorts of other people, and they'll be trying to keep themselves alive, and there's not really that safety there. So
we first met 6 years ago when we both had books on post-truth about, and I wonder if you go back to 2017, did you think it would be like this now, or better or worse, or did you have any sense of where we'd be?
So I look back at that and think, oh gosh, I thought it was bad then.
Exactly. It feels innocent now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I feel like we didn't save the day, Matt.
I know I didn't save the day.
I think it's our fault.
I think I was too optimistic, sadly.
I mean, part of what I did in the QAnon book, The Pandemic, which is my new one.
Recommended readers,
is slightly recant on... I think, you know, speaking of mine, I actually reread it not all that long ago. I think I had a good diagnosis of the problem and was completely naive as to how easy it would be to fix. I've sort of almost thrown out everything that I had as a solution there. And I think part of it is trust comes from how connected people feel to society. And that isn't just about how they feel about the media.
Yeah.
Is society working for them?
Yes.
And we've had an awful 6 years. You know, we've had a pandemic. We've got financial crises. We've got economic crises. We've got a brutal cost of living crisis. Yes. People are paying more tax than they ever have for worse services than they've had in living memory. And people look at that disconnect and want an explanation. And populism and conspiracy and division is always going to fill that. And of course, there's some dodginess in there, there's some fraud in there, but most of it is just the world sucks right now.
Mm. Yes.
And also we've got incompetence in charge of this particular country.
Quick question before we finish. Do you think X, Twitter, do you think it'll still be around in 3-5 years' time?
I think it will be around, but I don't think Elon will own it.
Okay.
I think it's heading for bankruptcy.
And who would pick up the pieces? A major news corp, perhaps, to run it responsibly, perhaps?
I wonder.
If the New York Times bought it and just said, you know, here's the terms of engagement.
Give us back our gold.
I mean, your tricky thing there is, I think you could probably... Depending how much it's from the ashes,
yeah,
you know, even if you really trash it, it's probably still worth $5 billion.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And you need someone to put the money in behind that, and you need someone to put in enough money to invest to rebuild it.
Yeah, okay.
Could you get VC backing a NYT coalition, or do they dislike each other too much?
Yeah, possibly.
Interesting.
But yeah, no, interesting.
Maybe you should buy it.
Well, we need a few more subscribers, folks, if we can start acquiring Twitter. Only but a few, anyway,
within range.
Do your little thing and subscribe to the New European. James, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
I hope you'll come in again on a regular basis. Pulitzer Prize winner, Jay. Pulitzer. I always love that. Jealous of very few people, but I'd love to be able to say Pulitzer Prize winner. But anyway,
it is quite nice.
It's very good. Nice. It's pretty good.
Thank you, James. Read Thank James every much. Week in the New European. Read Matt D'Ancona every week in the New European. And subscribe.
In that order.
So thank you very much, James Ball. Hope you will come on again. Matt, fantastic episode. I really enjoyed all of that.
Really enjoyed it.
What didn't we have time to talk about?
Well, I suppose we didn't talk about Keir Starmer having trouble with his own Muslim backbenchers and councillors over the war. And I think that story is going to grow.
Yes.
And he is wavering a bit. But it's a serious problem for him.
Yeah.
Because I think this war is going to go on. I think it's going to be, I'm afraid to say, I think it's going to be pretty horrible. And, you know, Starmer nailed his colours to the Israeli mask very quickly, and I think felt that was right, but also felt that he couldn't have any clear blue water between himself and Sunak.
Yes.
The centre of gravity in the Labour Party is very different to the centre of gravity in the Tory Party on the Middle East.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
This is not going to go away.
Yeah. I had a great couple of days off at the beginning of the week, and I went to Brighton, where my son's at uni, and we stayed at the Grand,
the historic hotel.
It was, and it's lovely, I have to say. They've really, really done a great job on it. But it's been
refurbished.
It's been refurbished, and it was really, really pleasant treat. But, you know, I went with my 9-year-old son, my 16-year-old daughter, and my 18-year-old who's at Sussex Uni. And it is remarkable. I mean, one was talking about the history of the Grand Hotel and the bombing and how much of my early political experience that opens up. But I did think, you know, we sit here moaning about things, quite rightly, I think, about the state of the country and that. But at least we're not being bombed by terrorists on our own land, you know. So you can make a case for saying that in some ways that there's been a lot of progress since those days, you know. And that magnificent hotel is a kind of analogy for the structural progress we've made, although maybe it's still full of tosses.
It's interesting. Well, it's interesting hearing how often the Good Friday Agreement is being cited all over the world as how things can resolve themselves.
Yeah.
Although I fear, you know, we're a long way in the Middle East from the Good Friday Agreement.
But
it does show... It does show that things that are intractable apparently can cease to be intractable.
Yeah, let's hope so. Anything else?
Well, just one other thing, which is a film I saw during London Film Festival, which is now on Apple and in some cinemas, The Pigeon Tunnel, which is a movie documentary about the late John le Carré.
Fantastic.
Made by Errol Morris, who I think with Ken Burns is probably, you know, the other great documentarian alive in the world. Mm. And it's a fantastic movie because it's a... Errol Morris is not not backward at coming forward. And he has taken on some great figures in the past, did a brilliant film on Rumsfeld. And he jousts with le Carré, who loves it because, of course, you know, le Carré is a former spy himself and loves the dance and the ritual of the interrogation and the interview. And it's just a beautifully made piece of cinema. I can't recommend it highly
enough. What's it called again?
The Pigeon Tunnel.
The Pigeon Tunnel, which is on Apple TV, is it?
Yeah, it's on Apple TV and in some cinemas, but it's really worth a couple of hours of your time.
Excellent stuff. Well, I'll look forward to watching that.
No, definitely worth watching.
And of course, Bill Kenwright
died. Yeah,
very sad. The Everton chairman and owner for a long time. And of course, great.
Huge figure in
theatre impresario. Yes. They dimmed the lights on Broadway on Thursday night.
Did they?
Yeah, and also on in the West End in London. So a big loss. I only ever met him once. He was a great Scouser. Tim Walker, who does our Mandrake column.
Oh, yes, I know Tim.
Had a play on, and Bill Kenwright's a mate of his, or was sadly, you know, now he's passed, was a mate of his. And it was at the time when Everton, and all my family are Evertonians, and I'm a Liverpudlian, so I'm really the black sheep. And anyway, so I went up to introduce myself to Bill Kenwright. And it was at the time when he was having trouble with, they were in the relegation zone, and he was tussling with this Russian who owned a big chunk of it. And it was all very awkward. Tim introduced me very kindly. And I said to him, so Bill, how's it going? I've never met him. And he just looked me in the eyes and said, fucking shite. Which I thought, okay, that's something. And it's hard to take a conversation on from that.
You know, there's a Matt Kelly's meeting with Mogul's book, Christmas book in this. Because I saved Rupert Murdoch's life the other day, and now
And I depressed Bill Kenwright.
I mean, it writes itself. It's fantastic. It
really, but anyway, Bill Kenwright, one of the greats. Rest in peace, mate. I hope it's blue wherever you are. So thank you very much indeed, folks, for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. As a reminder, you can get a fantastic subscriptions offer when you sign up to The New European. You get a free copy of James O'Brien's wonderful new book, How They Broke Britain, and James has signed those copies. I have to say there's only a few copies left now, so steam in while they're available.
While supplies last.
They are at www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2MATS. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. Thank you very much, as always, to our wonderful production team, Maya, Ollie, and the third Matt at Rethink Audio. And for now,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.